Welcome to the March 2026 News Bulletin podcast for commercial shipping marine surveyors, put together by the International Institute of Marine Surveying. We open our podcast with an introduction from IIAMS CEO Mike Schwartz. Dear member and fellow marine professionals, this month I want to address the matter of recurring safety issues in our industry, and I pose the simple question, to which there is no easy answer: what are the barriers to progress? Of course, I don't have the answers. But as a joined-up, interconnected industry, perhaps we could do as we seek to make incisive inroads into ship, crew and vessel safety. Over the years, the realization for enhanced safety training and mechanisms has grown and is now accepted as the norm, as have their implementation, but still, we see the same old type of incidents and accidents reoccurring. So, do we have an issue with the safety culture and why are we not learning from history and the past? Let me set out the topics I would like to briefly talk about in this month's column to simulate thought and debate. In no order of importance, they are continuous, repeating accidents at sea in general, many of which are fatal, enclosed space deaths and pilot ladder fatalities. In early January, I joked with my colleague, Francis Burkett, who maintains our annual accident calendar, about how quiet things had been in the first week of the new year. But not really a joking matter, and I had spoken too soon. Because the following weeks of January brought sad news of a plethora of worldwide accidents involving ship fires, numerous groundings, ferry capsizes, fishing vessel sinkings, multiple fatalities and more. I know, as you know, that the sea is such a dangerous environment in which to operate, but I question how many of these incidents were due to the human element. Time will tell. When I joined IIAMS 12 years ago, I was horrified to learn about the number of deaths in enclosed spaces. They were a regular occurrence and fatalities were high. Roll on a decade or more and the situation seems no better. Well, that is what last year's statistics would seem to suggest. Again, my question is simply why. Training is in place, of course, but is it to do with a lack of personal risk assessment, poor judgment, or just becoming complacent? And finally, pilot deaths, another vexing subject, which is not as much debated as it perhaps could be. I suspect this is because maritime pilot deaths are fortunately quite rare, but I am aware of two fatal accidents already in 2026. In the recent MAIB investigation report into the pilot fatality on board Finhawk, Chief Inspector of Accidents, Captain Andrew Moll OBE, said, "While superficially this was a simple accident, our investigation identified safety concerns across the training, equipment, medical standards and emergency response, and this report addresses all of these. Nobody should go to work and not return at the end of the day. One of the primary roles of the marine surveyor is to do all they can to preserve the safety of life at sea, as well as keeping cargo and valuable assets safe and secure. Please, as an industry, can we come together to redouble our efforts to improve safety standards and decrease the number of fatal accidents at sea? It is some while since we added to our collection of handy guides, but I am delighted to say with the publication, What a Marine Surveyor Needs to Know About Marine Classification Society and Statutory Surveys, an introduction, we have now reached 30 in total. Immediate past president, Peter Broad, has authored this one, which will be of use to anyone thinking of undertaking this type of work. The same author is also working on another handy guide covering the subject of giving expert witness. Survey well, Mike. Our first story expands on our newest handy guide, What a Marine Surveyor Needs to Know About Marine Classification Society and Statutory Surveys, an introduction. The aim of this handy guide is to give you an introduction to the following. What are marine classification societies? Who carries out marine classification society surveys? Where and when are marine classification society surveys carried out? What are statutory surveys? Who carries out marine statutory surveys? Where and when are marine statutory surveys carried out? Visit our website to buy your copy. Our second story highlights this year's IIAMS Baltimore Conference. Despite one of the most severe winter storms for many years and heavy snowfall blanketing the Baltimore area, it did little to dampen the spirits of the delegates who managed to get to the venue, nor those who joined virtually from the warmth of their own accommodation, of course. The annual conference, county hosted by James, Randy, Wren, honorary fellowship member, Ray Brackenfull member, and Mike Schwartz, took place at the MIT AGS facility on the outskirts of Baltimore and drew an audience of around 50 delegates, including a number of non-members. Bill Wayant tackled the thorny subject of surveyor ethics, delivering a reminder of the values and high standards to be met by all marine surveyors at all times. Craig Norton, Inspect X, gave delegates a deep dive into the world of AI and some of the GPTS that are available, their strengths and weaknesses and how surveyors can take advantage of them in a controlled fashion. Pat Durham displayed his extensive knowledge to highlight and bring to the attention of those present the dangers and challenges of lithium-ion batteries. John Mallall gave an in-depth update on health and safety issues affecting all surveyors with a sharp reminder that things can and do go wrong. Chase Eshelman spoke eloquently about giving expert witness and mentioned an increasing shortage of those coming forward to do this work. Andrew Kimsey presented on the relationship between surveyor and underwriter and explained what is expected. Other topics that featured over the 2 days included dealing with mold and termite attack on boats and water sampling. The event was brought to a close by Lloyd Griffin with his ever-popular, regular You Can't Make This Up review with photographs of some of the crazy things he has seen on survey in recent weeks. And for our next report, the United States Coast Guard has sent out a warning following a manufacturer recall of nearly 50,000 affected signal flares. The Coast Guard Office of Design and Engineering Standards was notified of a manufacturer recall of the Orion Skyblazer 2 Red XLT aerial signal, also called Orion XLT Skyblazer self-contained red meteor flare, due to 3 incidents of spontaneous combustion. There were no reported injuries. Affected flares were manufactured between March 1, 2025, and November 24, 2025, and have expiration dates of August 2028 through April 2029. You can find out more at IIMS USA website. Up next, in a first of its kind, the Directorate General of Shipping has developed a comprehensive safety video series to improve safety awareness across the maritime workforce. This landmark project has been initiated by the Indian Maritime Administration with the aim of minimizing accidents and incidents at sea. The safety video series will supplement the safety circulars and advisories being issued by DGS about the lessons learned from the incidents. The safety video series can be found on the DGS YouTube channel at dgshipping-india. More videos will be added to the channel at regular intervals. In our next segment, the Sailors' Society, IIMS President Captain Ruchindale's chosen charity, has a range of exciting fundraising challenges to take part in 2026. Created for maritime professionals, these events offer unique opportunities to make new connections and build on existing ones. They include the TCS London Marathon My Way 2026 on the 26th of April, cycling or hiking event Miles for Mariners held on the Isle on the 13th of June, and Trekking Challenge Summit for seafarers up Mount Fansipan in Vietnam from the 27th to the 30th of November. Come and support our cause at sailors-society.org. Next, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority Marine Incident Annual Report 2024 revealed AMSIR received 5,625 marine incident reports, a 2.8% increase from the previous year. This report provides an analysis of marine incidents reported in the 2024 calendar year, along with trends from 2020 to 2024, for domestic commercial vessels, foreign flagged vessels and regulated Australian vessels. In 2024, AMSIR received a total of 1,182 reports of marine incidents involving DC versus. This represents an increase of 5% from 2023 and a 55.5% increase in the number of marine incident reports from DC versus since 2020. In 2024, there were 3 fatal DC 5th marine incidents which resulted in 4 operational-related fatalities. In 2024, AMSIR received a total of 258 reports of marine incidents involving RA versus. This represents a decrease of 3.4% from 2023. Consistent with port arrivals data, most marine incident reports from foreign flagged vessels in 2024 were from bulk carriers. In 2024, there was 1 operational-related seafarer fatality on a foreign flagged vessel. There were no passenger fatalities reported in 2024. You can download the report via the AMSIR website. In our next report, new EU ETS rules take effect from January 2026. After a 2-year phase-in, maritime transport will face full compliance under the EU ETS, alongside an expanded scope covering additional greenhouse gases and a tighter emissions cap. The 2025 Carbon Market report, published by the European Commission in December, shows that the EU ETS continued to drive significant emissions reductions in the power and industrial sectors throughout 2024. According to the report, emissions from power and industrial installations covered by the EU ETS are now around 50% below 2005 levels. The EU ETS now covers 100% of emissions from voyages between two ports within the European Economic Area and emissions generated while ships are at an EEA port, and 50% of emissions from voyages departing from or arriving at ports outside the EEA. The European Commission will conduct a review of the EU ETS for maritime transport in 2026. This review will assess a potential extension of the system to ships below 5,000 gross tonnage, but not below 400 gross tonnage, and relevant developments at the International Maritime Organization. To read the full article, visit www.iams.org.uk. Next, Britannia P&I Club has highlighted a case in which a crew member was seriously injured after steel plates crushed him. Three crew members were moving 10 pieces of steel plate around the steering gear room while the ship was underway. Each piece measured approximately 2.4 meters by 1.2 meters and 5 millimeters thick, weighing around 110 kilograms. After transferring the plates to their new location, two crew members were holding the plates against adjacent railings, while another crew member was trying to secure the plates to the railings using a rope. The ship rolled unexpectedly due to large swell, which resulted in the plates moving and falling on top of the crew member who was attempting to secure them with a rope, partially crushing him as he tried to escape. The injured person was fortunate that the other crew members were there to help remove the plates which had fallen onto him. However, he did suffer very serious leg, arm, and internal injuries. The ship was diverted so that he could receive emergency medical treatment, and he spent 6 weeks in hospital before his condition stabilized sufficiently to allow repatriation home to continue medical treatment there. The investigation after the incident revealed that whilst a risk assessment and toolbox talk had been carried out, they were found to have been done improperly. During the risk assessment process, the risk of personal injury was identified as highly likely, and therefore the task should not have been carried out without suitable mitigation measures being in place. It was also found that the toolbox talk was treated as a tick box exercise only, the risks were not discussed, and the job was not adequately supervised as per the work plan. You can Britannia's article, including its recommendations, via britanniap&i.com. Up next, Interferry, the global trade association for the ferry industry, has called for an immediate halt to the further phasing in of the EU ETS for the maritime sector. The demand follows the recent decision to continue exempting road transport from a parallel ETS mechanism and the lack of clear regulations on the distribution of the funds collected. Interferry is calling for an immediate halt on the further implementation of the EU ETS for the ferry sector, maintaining the surrendering obligation for maritime emissions frozen at the 70% level scheduled for 2025, and halting the planned increase to 100% in 2026. Interferry supports decarbonisation of the maritime industry and accepted the EU ETS on the clear understanding that funds collected would actually be used for decarbonisation and that road transport would also soon be included. The EU Council recently decided to postpone the inclusion of road transport, raising significant concerns in the short sea shipping sector as to why end users of maritime transports, for example island communities, have to carry the full costs of ETS. Read Interferry's full press release at interferry.com. In our next report, biofuel reduces black carbon emissions by 81%. Experts from the CleanShip project document that using biodiesel, specifically B100 FAME, during normal operation can reduce black carbon emissions by up to 81% compared to traditional marine gas oil. The measurements were carried out on the Uni Tankers vessel Falstria Swan, where an advanced online black carbon sensor from Green Instruments, developed in collaboration with Danish Technological Institute, made it possible to track emissions in detail and in real time during the vessel's normal operation. Although biodiesel demonstrates a significant reduction in black carbon, current global production of biofuel can only cover a small share of the global fleet's total energy demand. Therefore, the CleanShip project continues to analyze data and work towards recommendations on how black carbon and other emissions can be effectively reduced in shipping. For our next report, Electrical Cadet Died of Asphyxia, BMA investigation concludes. On the 21st of January 2025, an electrical cadet on board Bahamas-flagged passenger ship, Grandeur of the Seas, went into an access space to troubleshoot a level transmitter for a bilge water settling tank. He attempted to exit the space but lost his footing on a ladder he placed outside and became stuck in a suffocating position. Post-casualty tests of the atmosphere inside the access space confirmed the presence of hydrogen sulfide gas. Conclusions: an electrical cadet died as a result of probable mechanical, positional, asphyxia after entering an access space to troubleshoot a level transmitter for a bilge water settling tank. He was unaware that any hazards were present. Having previously worked in the space under supervision, he believed the conditions would be the same. The access space was not designed to accommodate continuous work by shipboard staff, and the sensor had no technical reason to be located inside the space. The space was also not designated as enclosed, confined, or dangerous, thus there were no safety precautions in effect involving work inside the access space. The transfer history in the oil record book indicated that various sources of untreated water had been transferred into bilge water settling tank, M4, and contributed to favorable conditions for hydrogen sulfide gas formation. The first stage sensor for the bilge water settling tank had been relocated outside at an unknown point in the vessel's history, indicating a need to avoid potential hazards in entering the access space for troubleshooting the sensor. The second stage level transmitter was also relocated outside of the access space post-casualty, ensuring ease of access for any future maintenance required. You can download the full report via our website. Next, the hazards posed by small lithium-ion batteries can be devastating, says P&I Club North Standard. From handheld radios, cell phones, and power banks to vapes and flashlights, lithium-ion batteries are everywhere on board vessels. While the maritime industry has rightly focused on the dangers of lithium-ion battery fires on car carriers and container vessels, the hazards posed by small lithium-ion batteries are often overlooked and can be just as devastating in confined shipboard environments. Real fires, real lessons. Bridge blaze on tanker. A handheld radio battery overheated and ignited, burning down the bridge navigation and communication equipment, causing $3 million in damage. Cabin combustion. Rechargeable power bank, vapes, and cell phones left charging overnight have sparked fires in crew quarters, often due to unsupervised charging or poor storage. Power bank peril. A crew member's power bank exploded during charging in a locker, igniting nearby clothing and causing smoke inhalation injuries. The P&I Club shared some smart safety practices for small lithium-ion batteries on board, including tips covering responsible purchase, vessel and personal use, storage and handling, charging, inspection and maintenance, emergency preparedness, disposal and documentation, and crew awareness and training. You can read the full article at north-standard.com. In our next segment, the International Association of Classification Societies has announced a landmark revision to its Unified Requirement URM 78, introducing comprehensive safety requirements for marine engines fueled by ammonia. The newly published Revision 4 of URM 78 expands its scope to include ammonia as an approved fuel for reciprocating internal combustion engines. This development reflects IACKS's commitment to enabling innovative propulsion technologies while maintaining the highest safety standards. It will be uniformly applied by IACKS member societies for engines with type approval applications dated on or after 1 July 2027. Up next, West P&I Club has highlighted the issue surrounding loading group AIMSBC cargoes during wet weather. The club said it has recently seen several instances regarding loading bulk cargoes that are categorized as Group A cargoes under the IMSBC code during precipitation. Group A cargo should never be loaded where it has been determined that the moisture content of the cargo exceeds the transportable moisture limit. It is therefore understandable that some vessels opt to restrict the amount of moisture that the cargo is exposed to by avoiding loading during periods of precipitation. However, the IMSBC code does allow loading of Group A cargoes in certain situations. The club expands on several Group A cargo schedules within the IMSBC code which have specific provisions in place for wet weather loading in its report. You can read the full report at westpni.com. For our next story, the Swedish club has shared a case study in which grain beneath hatch panels was damaged after a vessel encountered severe weather conditions. In late November, a geared bulk carrier was loading grain at a US West Coast port, with Asia as the discharge destination. Prior to commencement of loading, the cargo holds were inspected and passed by a surveyor in accordance with current USDA, FDA standards. The vessel's crew had also prepared the cargo holds and hatch covers in line with ISM requirements and industry guidelines, which included cleaning the hatch combing channels and hose testing of the hatch covers. No signs of water ingress were detected during the pre-loading inspection. During the first day of loading, intermittent rain showers occurred. The master ordered the hatch covers to be closed and secured in accordance with customary practice and safety management procedures. Once the rain stopped, the hatches were reopened. Upon completion of loading, the master signed clean bills of lading. Fumigation was carried out by a certified contractor in line with IMO recommendations on fumigation, and the hatch covers were sealed with modern self-adhesive barrier tape. The vessel's charterer, who had contracted weather routing services, alerted the master to several depressions forming in the North Pacific. Based on routing advice, the vessel proceeded on a southerly course to avoid the strongest swells. Despite this, after 3 days at sea, the vessel encountered very heavy weather conditions with sustained northerly winds of Beaufort Force 10 and significant wave heights exceeding 8 meters. The vessel pounded heavily into the seas, shipping green water on deck. As a result, the protective hatch sealing tape was washed away. The master adjusted the route further south until the storm subsided 2 days later. Upon arrival at the discharge port, inspection revealed seawater traces on the inner hatch combing plating of cargo holds 1 and 2. The forward location of these holds made them more exposed to shipping seas during the storm. Cargo damage was confirmed. Grain beneath the hatch panels on the starboard side had suffered wetting and mold damage. A joint survey was conducted, including ultrasonic and chalk testing of the hatch cover arrangements. The ultrasonic test showed that the cross joints between forward and aft hatch cover panels of hold number 1 were leaking. In addition, chalk tests on hold number 2 confirmed poor compression between sealing rubbers and the cross joint compression bars. The surveyor noted that several gasket sections were aged and should have been renewed. Sealing rubbers require replacement of entire lengths once deteriorated, as isolated patch repairs are no longer regarded as acceptable. The remaining cargo holds were in satisfactory condition and discharged without incident. You can find the case study, including questions to help you further consider whether this could happen on your vessel, via our website. In our next report, Bureau Veritas has shared a summary on the 12th session of IMO Subcommittee on Ship Design and Construction, which was held earlier this year. SDC 12 agreed on the following: draft amendments to the 2011 ESP code, with a view to approval in principle by MSC 111, formal approval by MSC 113 and adoption by MSC 114, as appropriate. Draft guidelines on the use of remote inspection techniques with a view to adoption by MSC 111, in conjunction with the adoption of the draft amendments to the 2011 ESP code to allow the use of RIT in ESP code surveys. Draft amendments to the technical provisions for means of access for inspections with a view to approval by MSC 111 and adoption by MSC 112. Draft explanatory notes for safe return to port and orderly evacuation and abandonment after a fire or flooding casualty with a view to approval by MSC 111. Draft amendments to Chapter 6 of the 2009 MODU Code with a view to adoption by MSC 111. Draft revised fiber-reinforced plastic guidelines, use of FRP elements within ship structures and the fire testing method for both load-bearing and non-load-bearing elements, with a view to adoption by MSC 111. 2-year extension of the underwater radiated noise experience building phase with a consequent target completion year 2028, as well as draft technical guidance on co-optimizing energy efficiency and underwater radiated noise at the design and retrofit stage with a view to approval by MEPC 84. SDC 12 also established the following: a correspondence group to implement the work plan according to the terms of reference proposed to develop the safety regulatory framework concerning the lithium-ion batteries used as the main source of electrical power and lighting systems, the interim guidelines for wind propulsion and the revision of Solus 8 and nuclear code. A correspondence group to develop the performance standard for engine control room alarm management ECRAM and SDC 12 decided not to amend Solus 2-2/13.4.1.1 and 13.4.2.1 as regards means of escape and requested the revocation of MSC 1-Circular 1689. Issues related to PSC are to be discussed within the Subcommittee on Implementation of IMO Instruments. You can read the full summary at group.bureauveritas.com. Next, Lloyd's Register has published a report, Fuel for Thought, Hydrogen, which examines hydrogen from production and supply through to onboard use, highlighting the fuel's advantages alongside the safety, infrastructure and cost challenges that currently restrict its adoption. The report notes that while interest is rising, particularly as regulatory measures tighten, hydrogen-capable vessels still represent less than 0.5% of the global order book. You can the report at lr.org. For our penultimate report, The latest annual data from DNV's Alternative Fuels Insight platform showed that within the container segment, alternative fuels dominated, with the fuel mix by tonnage approximately 58% LNG, 36% conventional fuels, and 6% methanol. A total of 275 orders for alternative fueled vessels were placed in 2025, representing a year-on-year decrease of 47%. This mirrored a broader drop in the overall newbuild market, which fell to 2,403 orders, from 4,405 in 2024. Despite this downturn, container ship contracting showed resilience, rising to 547 new orders from 447 in 2024 and accounting for roughly 49% of all gross tonnage and 68% of alternative fuel new orders. Reflecting the container segment's strength, LNG-fueled vessels led the alternative fueled market across all ship types in 2025, accounting for 188 orders and representing 31% of total gross tonnage. And for our final report, we'll share two new appointments. First, the Council of the International Association of Classification Societies has announced the election of Alex Greg Smith as its next chair. He will assume the role on the 1st of July and his term of office will run until the 31st of December 2027. He has over 20 years' experience with Bureau Veritas, as well as extensive experience in leadership roles in both shipyards and shipowners. And secondly, Leslie Robinson OBE has decided to relinquish her role as Chief Executive of British Marine this summer after 8 years in post. A structured transition plan is in place, with Earl Stanner, current Chief Finance and Operations Officer, being appointed as the organization's next Chief Executive. That's all we have for this month. Thanks for listening.